Hi, and welcome to Journey to a Dream, which is brought to you by Kawasaki Insurance and also supported by the Andreas Racing Association. And at the moment, we're talking to some of the newcomers who are going to be on the start line for MGP 2025 for the first time. We're going to continue that today by speaking to a local rider. So he's from the island. He's well used to travelling quickly, not only when he's racing, but also for his day job as well. Let's meet him now.
I'm Blake Kelly, local to the island and currently living in Douglas, but my heart's up in Ramsey, really. Oh, I'd like to see. Just East Coast, I think, does it? The racing is getting there, I think. Slowly getting better every time. It's working. Plenty of setbacks, but that's what I enjoy doing is working on the bike. So, you know, enjoy fixing it as much as I do riding it.
And when did this all start, Blake? When did you think, actually, biking is something that's going to be a big part of my life?
Oh, I think to pinpoint it is probably difficult. I got my bike license in 2017. So fairly late on. I actually remember picking up the ZX6, which was my first sort of big bike, and I thought it was illegal. Picked it up in Onken, was going back to Lexi at the time, and I thought, how's this legal that I've just come and bought this bike? Because until you ride a sport bike, you don't know acceleration. I'm coming from a 125 straight to that. So that's probably when I first decided, you know what, yeah, I want to ride bikes, and then it took a first track day to go, you know what, I want to do this is racing. But before that, I think maybe really childhood level, my mum had a bike, and she was told very firmly by my granddad that you are not riding anymore as soon as she found out she was pregnant with me. So I've got some really old pictures of me sat on a, it was a bright red Suzuki Bandit, I think. And that probably just sort of tripped it off and, you know, stood in the Corrie Park in Ramsey waiting for Joey to go around and watching the racing. That probably triggered it. And then it was just that life got in the way and I couldn't actually do it until fairly late on.
Did your mum stick to granddad's rules?
Yeah, I think she sat in that category, however it worked with licences, that she was allowed to ride, but then I think it changed, so she'd have to get a licence again when it renewed. And a few years ago, she was trying to go through learning again, but I think she's just, yeah, not too interested anymore.
And did she have anything to say about you following that sort of line of things?
Yeah, she didn't really say much, but certainly for the first couple of years, she wasn't super enthusiastic hearing about the racing and was happy that I was making videos with the YouTube but couldn't really watch them. And it took a while for her to come up and actually watch a race, and then she sort of went, oh, hang on, actually, you know, you don't sit on a bike and as soon as you get on track you die, which I think she was just worried about. So yeah, she's quite supportive now and got over that fear of it.
It's a justified fear to have, isn't it? We know that most sport can be dangerous, but then we should also say that for a living you do something which potentially has its own dangers as well.
Yeah, it's kind of part and parcel of the fire services that we take risks. We just do it in a very calculated way, and that's kind of the same as what we're doing. We're out racing, you know, you have all of the systems in place, you ease into it, and you do it in a very calculated way. You just don't go out there and decide, I'm going to stick myself in that wall. Everyone has that switch in their head that sort of says, don't do that. And yeah, when you're pushing the limits of anything, you are going to find them eventually. That's what happens. But I've always been a big ambassador for bikes on track because I had quite a big crash early on, and because I've always have cameras on the bike. When they work, you can look back and see stuff. And it just so happened that I had a massive crash, and within, it was something like 16 seconds, there was sirens, and then people were on me on there. And when you're on the road, there's so many variables, and it is dangerous, that I do like to try and tell everyone I possibly can that track is safer.
So you did your first couple of track days and then really thought this was something that you wanted to pursue. How easy has that journey been for you?
Reasonably, I'd say that there's quite a good sort of framework in place. I had the complication that the way you go from racing to getting up to be able to sort of get out on the roads, which was always the goal from day one. As soon as I went on my first track day and was like, yeah, right, what do I want to do now? I want to go racing and I want to go road racing. That was from day one, so everything has been for that. Unfortunately, the work schedule got in the way quite a lot. I'm in a good position now, or a better position, that I'm working 9 to 5, which frees up the weekends, because that's pretty much just when racing happens. So it's been easier recently, but yeah, certainly in the start, before I joined the service as well, work didn't pay as well. It's an expensive game to be getting into, so that just meant sacrificing more. You do what you want to do, don't you, to get the drive at the end. Yeah, it's getting there.
Yeah, I can imagine being on call and stuff like that would have just thrown any sort of racing schedule out of the window, because you're just so unpredictable.
Yeah, and a bigger issue is lots of caveats in the system that it works, that I wouldn't know when I could get the time off work from being on shift until the end of, I think it's February or March, which is usually long after the calendars have gone out for racing things. So I've never been able to stick to one championship. It was sort of, if I had to go over to the UK, then it would be, right, well, which club's racing on the weekend that is the easiest to get to, which is a bit of a pain. And when you're actually booking off from the on-call side of it, you could only do that around 8 days in advance. There's a lot of times where it's like, well, I've booked on to go racing and then I'm waiting to see, can I actually do it? And a lot of colleagues are helpful. You know, you can swap over it and cover things, but yeah, you're reliant on a lot of extra things. And I do like to be somewhat planned ahead, unless it comes to fixing the bike, because you should always do that the night before. But yeah, when it comes to planning that way, that's been difficult.
Okay, we'll come back to fixing the bike the night before a little bit later. But in terms of then you having this goal, you always knew that road racing was going to be the thing. What do you remember about your first road race?
So weirdly, my first road race was the Pre-TT Classic last year, and that was on a bike that I bought on Facebook Marketplace for £200, and it was never intended to go racing, and I just so happened to put an entry in and then suddenly got one back and thought, oh, that bike that was sat in the corner that I was going to pull parts off now needs to be priority number one. And when we were up in the holding area, I just remember my heart kind of going quite mad. And I'd done a lot of prep with a guy who was very helpful called Jez Hill from down south, who's incredibly knowledgeable both in the racing but also in those bikes specifically. And he offered to take me around for an open roads lap, and it took us, I think, just over an hour. And it was sort of, we'd go around and stop, and it's 4.25 miles down at Balland, but to do that in an hour, and we were out, we were stopped, and we were looking at stuff, and it was a massive help just from this guy that I'd met through someone else on the internet because of the bike I'd bought, which was incredible. Yeah, then we finally got out there. There's one moment that does make me think, oh, that was a bit weird. And you get out and you're always wondering, what's it going to be like racing on the road? Because you know the road, but then you're racing and, you know, there's all these walls and what's going to go on. And it didn't seem any different to a circuit until I came round Stadium Corner and there was someone behind the wall and they were waving. And my first thought was, what are they doing so close to the track? Like, oh, yeah, this is a road. And that sort of stuck with me. It's just, I think once your visor goes down, you just get into that zone and it doesn't really matter. Then you're looking for your markers, your apexes, as opposed to what's beside the track.
And how did that bike hold up?
It's still going quite strong, yeah. Hopefully going to get it out at the Classic TT. So I've got the entry back. There's a few things that have complicated recently, but the bike will be getting some modifications to make it a bit more suitable for that. But again, the help I've had from Jez at Jap Racing has been incredible. They were never officially a UK bike, so they were all what they call grey imports that came in. And there's pretty much two people in the UK that were racing them, and then they decided, right, well, we'll develop parts for them. So they were the go-to people. And yeah, it's through them that I met Jez. But yeah, we'll try and get it out. I'm in two minds at the minute as to whether to pull that entry, and I don't want to, but there was a few things that happened at Southern that sort of made me realise that, well, we don't really have the space for two bikes at the minute. So trying to work on that angle, but also I'm aware I don't want to bite off more than I can chew at the Grand Prix. And it's the same as any of the events. I love telling myself, well, what's the problem? What could go wrong? What's going to happen here? And then get out there and it's fine. But yeah, in the build-up, it's like, oh, what if this happens? What's the unknown is the biggest one. You know, we can plan for everything. We've got quite a slick team at the minute. We know what we're doing and it works. But there's just that big question mark of, well, I've spent lots of time up in the paddock doing the fire cover or helping other people out racing, but I've never been there full-on just doing it myself. And yeah, it just niggles in the back of my mind of, well, what if there's something I don't know that could happen? What's the unknown? And yeah, yeah. We'll see.
That just goes back to you talking about, you know, those calculated risks. It sounds like you're a person who processes things and sort of thinks through various scenarios.
Yeah, I love an information dump. Some people, they don't want the details. I want the details, the A, the B, the C, the everything coming together. And I do like grabbing as much information as I can and processing that data, so to speak. Yeah, that's just how I work. So when there is question marks or things that I don't know, just don't like it. Yeah, I suppose that's about being in control, isn't it? I don't like being in the passenger seat.
Sidecar's not for you then?
Very briefly did give
it
a go.
You?
Yeah, a friend, Jim Gale, offered to take me out, and I think I lasted nearly two laps at Jerby. I was like, no, I don't think, yeah. I'm glad I did. It was very interesting. A massive respect for the sidecar boys, but yeah, not my cup of tea.
Maybe
have a go at driving.
Driving. You mentioned the Southern. When was your first Southern?
So that was last year as well.
And how did that compare to the pre-TT?
I think it was pretty good. So the pre-TT, the little bike, the 400, is obviously not particularly powerful, so it was a really good way to learn it. And then stepping up to the Southern, we went out on, had a little mini twin at the time, which was sort of the next step up. And then the session after that was out on the R6, which was triple figure horsepower. And yeah, it was incredible. Just the same, but better. And one of my oldest childhood memories and what I properly associate with TT and Grand Prix is that sound of four cylinders screaming at, you know, 14,000 RPM. And then when you're in it and doing it, it was pretty incredible.
You see those people waving at you just a little bit quicker.
Yeah, they just become a little bit more blurry.
You mentioned Jerby. You're obviously a racer with the Andreas Racing Association as well. And we talk about it so much in this podcast because it's such a fundamental thing, particularly for Isle of Man riders. And I guess great to have that, what is essentially a grassroots organisation over here where you can just go up and compete.
Yeah, massively. And it's more than just an organisation up there. I mean, the bike community is pretty good anyway. The Manx community is pretty good. So when you've got a bike community on the Isle of Man, it is fantastic. Yeah, it wouldn't have been possible without the ARA. It's the easiest place that we can get access to circuits. It allows us to meet lots of people. There's loads of knowledge up there. I was quite surprised, and it really showed how little you can know someone that you think you know. Listening to the podcast when you had Linda on, and I didn't know she'd done any of that in the background, and I sort of had a bit of an idea, and it's incredible the knowledge that's up there. And sometimes you get it when you need a bit of help and people are volunteering, and they straight away come up and, you know, do you know this is happening, or can we help with that? When I had a problem with gazebo last year, there was a couple of people from the ARA said, well, the club's got one up in Jerby, you know, can you go and get it? I'm like, there's no way I can go and get it. Well, it's all right, we'll try and find someone to bring it down to you. And it's just really helpful because everyone's there for one reason. You know, when you're out on track, it's a bit different because you want to make sure you finish in front of the guy in front, but it's all done with respect. And as soon as you come back in the paddock, it's great. You know, some of my best battles that I've had on track are back and forth. And even if ultimately I end up coming back behind the guy in front, it's straight away over, you know, handshakes. And that was incredible. That's what racing's about.
Well, you are hopefully then not very far away from sitting on that start line on Glen Crutchery Road. And I just, first of all, want to know when that entry went in, what your expectations are of it, and I suppose how you felt when you realised that you had been accepted.
So I remember getting the entry accepted back. So recently I left all my kit and the bike over in Spain because it was cheaper to fly to Spain and ride in Spain than it was to get a boat over to the UK. And they have this weird shiny thing in the sky quite a lot, so that was definitely a bonus. But we just got through security at the airport and were walking down. My phone had reconnected to the data and stuff out there. It just came through Manx Grand Prix. And I think I squealed like a little girl, to be honest, or very close to. I was absolutely over the moon just to get that back and get it confirmed. It was after the newcomers weekend that we did, where Milky basically told us, if you're here, you've got the entry. They were obviously just ticking the boxes and you sort of told and you're prepping for it. But for it to actually come through and go, yeah, this is happening, was incredible. And yeah, that's properly glued into my mind.
For somebody then who obviously lives over here, how important is it to have those newcomers weekends? Because, I mean, people will think, well, you know the course.
Yeah, I think we've definitely got a bit of a leg up on people. On the newcomers course, there was lads that came over that had never been to the island. And you can watch as many videos as you want. It will never show you how steep Bray Hill is, the climb up from Glen Helen. You never get gradient on a video. You're never going to see the little bumps. It's just different to when you can actually get out and see it. So we do have a bit of a benefit in that we kind of know the area. I don't want to get suckered into thinking I know it when it's closed, because it's going to be a different kettle of fish. I'm still wondering what it's going to look like driving down through, is it the Nook just before Governors? Because we don't go that way on open roads, do we? You know, I've been through on me mountain bike, but it's sort of, yeah, again, it's another thing. It's an unknown that I don't like because I don't know it. So wait till we see there. That sort of stands out. But yeah, we'll get on that. I don't want to get suckered into thinking I know it, but we definitely have an advantage being local just for knowing, well, yeah, it's a left that comes up. It's a right after that. This is the straight. And when people are talking about things and they know names, we probably know more than a lot of people.
You're also a blue light driving instructor. So does that mean that you are, I suppose, advanced when it comes to sort of driving at speed?
I'd say so. Yeah, it's a lot. It's very different when you're driving blue lights and you're driving faster than anyone else in the area, and you're doing quite, not necessarily unpredictable things, but there's certain rules on the road. You know, when you come round a corner, you expect nothing to be on your side of the road. You expect that if your traffic light's green, no one else is going to come from it. So when you're then doing the response driving, you're having to think for everyone else and share information with your sirens, your lights or your positioning, and doing that and influence what people are going to do whilst monitoring all the things you would do if you were normally driving. And then when you're an instructor, you're having to monitor all of that whilst seeing if someone's doing that. So although we don't really go over 70 mile an hour, you're doing that in very built up places where there's lots of other traffic, and it's just keeping calm and just calculating everything that's going on. So I think, yeah, when that does get onto the bike and you get up to speed, it does transfer. It probably does help. And just the worst thing you can do on a bike is panic. Yeah, I think it definitely transfers and probably helps. Had a little bit of a iffy moment at the Southern this year. We got out on the first session and got straight out into the holding area. And I was the second bike waiting. And the only one in front of me was Nathan Harrison, who I don't know if you know, he's a little bit quick. And for whatever reason, my brain, even though we were experimenting on gearing, we had a different suspension setup, so we weren't too sure on it. It's the first session of the week, and my silly man brain went, yeah, just follow him, keep up with him. And it took about the first corner to go, yeah, maybe that's not the best idea. And we came round through Iron Gate and on the approach to Joey's, and the bike didn't turn how I thought it was, whether that was gearing or steering. And where I should have been very much over to the left curb, I was very much in the right-hand lane. And I remember looking at Joey's gate open and thinking, am I going to have to go through there? Looking at the wall, looking back to where I should be and thinking, am I going to get round there? Looking back to the gate and thinking, no, I might have to do that. And then thinking, no, I'm going to carry on going round. And I remember that back and forth, clear as anything. I reckon it would have taken 15 seconds to think about that. And looking back on the video, it's a second, you know, it just looks like I've gone offline and gone round and not thought about it. And it's weird things like that. You definitely get up to a certain speed. There was a later session in the week where I came back and was quite happy with the time that I'd got. And obviously you're full of adrenaline, fully up to speed. And I came back and was pretty much just shouting at my friend Tom. And he just said, calm down. Because it was just, yeah, I was running at 110%, properly excited, up to that speed. And yeah, it slows down at that, I think. One of the bits of advice that Milky was giving us and the other instructors for when we're getting out on the mountain course, it's not the fast bits that are going to catch you out. It's making sure you go slow enough for the slow ones, because you'll get up and you'll sit above 100 mile an hour for minutes at a time and then come to Balaf Bridge. And I think Milky said, you know, you'll feel like you're able to step off the bike and you're still doing 50, 60 mile an hour. Yeah, okay. And yeah, there's a few things that have shown that in work and other things. It's like, yeah, I need to slow down and work on that.
Yeah, and I suppose coming into things like pit stops and stuff are quite a new thing for lots of the newcomers.
Actually, we've done really well at them. So I've done a couple of the end of season endurances up at Jerby, and with the crew we actually got a second place finish on what I think was the oldest bike out there. Was off the pace. I think it was Marcus Simpson that beat us in the 600, and he's quick anyway and was on a quicker machine, and we were quite off the pace on lap times, but we were relatively close overall because the pit stops were slick. And that was because I had everyone down and we were practicing them. I think when we did the rear wheel change, so we had the bike checked, we changed the rear wheel and fueled quicker than some of the teams were just putting fuel in. Again, it's like, well, let's not leave anything to it. So we'll do a similar thing in Grand Prix and just make sure there's no question marks. The bike's currently a bit poorly, so when it's backing together, I need to test that as well. But I'm also going to make sure that we test. So we'll go up to Jerby and we'll run it on the gearing for Grand Prix just to see if it does anything weird. We've got the big tall screen, so I'm going to make sure I use that in case it buffets or does anything weird. I've got a newcomer's, the orange vest. I've got one that, on Milky's advice to not use the one the ACU provide because it's a bit flappy. We've got one of those, and although I used it at Oliver's Mount, I don't know what it's like at any big speed, so I'll see if I can use that at Jerby, although I'm not a novice up there, but it's just another thing that I don't want to leave anything. We already know there might be some question marks somewhere, but if we can practice the pit stop, then why not? It's one less thing to go wrong, you know, to make sure people are stood in the right place and I know who I'm looking for, so I don't just drive past them. I was up in the pit lane doing fire cover this year, and there was a lad who went about six spaces past his pit crew, and the mechanics were straight down and grabbed it and reversed him while he was sat on the bike at full speed. I don't fancy that. I'll make sure I stop where I need to.
Get them to wear some big hat or something so you can see them easily, I guess.
Yeah, well fortunately we've got my race colours are pink, purple and teal, sort of 80s inspired synthwave neon. Love it. Very hard to miss. Somewhat helped by I once went past and my mum didn't notice and she said she didn't see me and then she just panics. And I know my partner Becky loves to panic as well. So, well, we'll make sure we're bright and we stand out and there's no messing on there. And I was looking for the pit suits because there's two different fire protection levels you have to have, depending on whether it's the person handling the fuel or just the mechanics that are in there. And I found one just, and it wasn't the right standard, but it matched the bike perfectly. And they made suits in the right standard, and I just fired them over an email with a picture of the bike and said, I know you make these in this colour, and I know you make these suits in the right level. Can we put them together? And yeah, they were very keen, so they've arrived.
Like an 80s pop band. I mean, is synth the music of choice before you go out?
I don't know, really. I didn't think I... People always ask, what's your ritual? And the only I like having my earplugs tucked into my visor and my helmet, and I don't know whether that's particularly a ritual. It's just I know where they are then, because I don't want to be looking around for them before I get back on. I was talking to Becky recently, and she said there's a point where I'm just about to go out where I go quiet, and she knows that she doesn't talk to me then, just leave it. And I can't say I've ever noticed that. I just thought, oh, you know, 1 minute I'm just wandering around, and then we go and ride the bike. But she said, yeah, there's a clear moment where I've obviously put that switch on in my brain, and she knows, yeah, just let him do his thing now and go out.
You know, as a fire officer, you'll be used to getting changed quickly as well. You can see you jumping into your leathers. Are you going to have that down to a fine art?
No, I don't think so. There's a lot of people, you see it up at Jerby, and they're in and out of their suit all day. They'll go out and qualify and then get out of it and then get back in. I'm pretty much once a minute, unless it's a ridiculously hot day, and I might get out of it for lunchtime, and you'll see me wandering around in, you know, Crocs and the base layers, scaring all the children. But yeah, I just tend to stay in it. I think there's probably the benefit as well of fire kit is really good at keeping heat out, but it also keeps heat in. It's like a thermal sleeping bag that's got sleeves, and that's probably helped me get used to the heat a bit, so maybe I just don't suffer from it as much.
Now, we talk a little bit about the support, and we'll mention some of your other sponsors in a moment, but you're also being supported by the Billy Redmayne Memorial Foundation as sort of one of the newcomers over here, and I just wanted to know what that means to you.
Yeah, absolutely massive, both metaphorically and the financial support as well. It's the most support I've had from anyone, really. I'm terrible for asking people for money. And yeah, to have the offer come through from Dave was incredible. And obviously it's quite an important thing, and it's local, and it's very special.
And again, it's those relationships, isn't it? And we've talked before that it is obviously the financial side of it is brilliant, but also just having that support on a practical level. And again, other people that you can go to and ask for advice, particularly Dave, you know, with his scrutineering background.
Yeah. So I was onto him recently, actually, with some oil filter questions at Southern 100. And yeah, it's rather than getting into a situation where something's wrong with the bike or it's not right for the regulations, and you find that out when you're in the tent, and then suddenly you've got spun around and got to change it. It's really good to be able to just open that contact line and go, Dave, what's right on here? Joe Warriner also gets quite a lot from on there. And then when it's not scrutineer related, usually Liz, the race secretary, she'll get a WhatsApp at any time in the morning. You know, Liz, what's this mean?
Is it Tracy's Pictures who support you as well?
Yeah, the backer newcomer. That's incredible. I think Tracy runs that every year and does incredible work for the newcomers. And when you're new to it, there's a lot of stress to go on anyway, and that's just one thing that takes it away, doesn't it? Just the extra bit of help for worrying what's going on. And she takes good pictures, so always a bonus that you can have that memory and, you know, spam it all over your Facebook.
And that's obviously something you're very used to doing. You mentioned the YouTube channel. Just tell us how that all started out.
I think it started off as a way for me to just keep busy, really. When I was out and riding, and I was watching a lot of bikers on YouTube, and it was quite baffling to me that we live on the home of motorcycles, and this is motorcycle mecca, and it was missing that angle. So I thought, right, I'll stick a GoPro on, and being aware of how many variables there are on the road, I thought it's best I have a camera going all the time anyway. And I used to always have it rolling, and then I put a microphone in the helmet and realized that I like to sing to myself and talk to the sheep and do all sorts of stuff, and start getting a bit of traction online, particularly when it came to TT. And it was like, well, do you know you can access these places with the roads that are closed, or have you seen this spot? And it allowed me to meet a lot of really cool people and just engage, and then it just kept snowballing from there. I don't do much on the road anymore, just because the more I spent on track, the less enjoyable the road was, and the more I realised that, well, actually, it's a bit iffy. It's only in the past 6 months that I've got a little 8-horsepower Grom that I'm enjoying getting back on the road again.
People can presumably find all the previous stuff you've done. I mean, do you do it when you're out racing as well?
Yeah, I do quite a lot. Unfortunately, it does get a bit patchy with the GoPros failing. I think there's too many bumps and stuff on a bike, so a lot of really good, like one of my best races ever was over at Anglesey, and there was four of us that at no point were any more than 6 foot away from each other, and we were swapping back and forth constantly, and we got back in and one of the cameras had just decided to turn off basically as the lights went, and then the other one only captured half of the session. And we've been plagued with quite a lot of issues from there. We've tried different cameras, memory cards and batteries and stuff, and we think we might have it now with one of the actual older GoPros, but it doesn't have a detachable battery, and it doesn't have all the fancy GPS or anything. It just records, and thankfully it seems to have been doing that. So we've got a lot of footage ready to go from pre-TT, Oliver's Mount, and from the Southern 100.
Do you put all that together? Have you got a team that help you with that?
No, it's just me. So a recent video was the Southern 100 from last year, and I think there was probably 40 hours in editing that, because once I get going on it, and then I'm quite particular about it, you know, it's my art sort of thing. You know, a musician will spend the time to make sure that their sound is right and the passion that comes through that, and that's similar to what I do with the videos. And because I'm not a professional at it, I was talking to my friend Brandon, who used to be a professional at it, still does some bits with Greenlight over at the Northwest, and he was asking me, like, oh, what's your workflow and how do you do this? Like, I don't know, just clunk it together. And fortunately, he's been helping on the editing side for a few bits. I've got a video from Aberdare that he's done quite a lot of work on. He's done what would probably have taken me a day in like 2 hours. So I'll just go in and finesse that. And the Southern as well as pre-TT as well, he's been actually filming, and he's an absolute wizard from it. So if you're ever on the Unrestricted Isle YouTube channel and you see a really lovely cinematic looking shot, it's Brandon.
And so where can people find this?
So we're on Facebook as Unrestricted Isle, YouTube Unrestricted Isle, and I do some bits on Instagram and TikTok as well, all under Unrestricted Isle. It's not super consistent, and it's not the same format anyway. You know, there's probably professional social media people going, that's not how you should do that, but it's just as it comes, really. Yeah, a lot of the feedback I've got is that it's very grassroots, and we show the good, the bad, the funny, the ups and the downs. It's not a polished corporate race team image that we're going for. It's just, you know what, we're a bunch of people that we like riding bikes. I'm racing. There's a lot of people that I've been very fortunate who've wanted to come along and help.
And we can hear you singing and talking to sheep. I mean, what's not to love?
Yeah.
We'll definitely put a link to that on the podcast page. You mentioned your bike was a little bit poorly at the moment. And you also said earlier something about the fact that you should prep your bike the day before a race. I'm presuming, though, obviously we're talking, we've got, 30 odd days or whatever it is till the start of MGP. There's going to be some work going on.
Yeah, so a little bit of superstition in there. There's probably only two times in my life that I've had a bike proper ready and early. I was talking to a friend recently, and he likes to have everything done and loaded in the van a week before. And I've tried that, and it always seems to go horribly wrong. And yet, although it's very stressful, you know, sometimes we've been working on the bike in the paddock the morning of or the night before, and it all seems to go quite well in the end. Yeah, although I like to be organized and plan things, I also, you know, like to do that right in the last minute. But at the minute, there's a bit of an issue. People keep asking me how Southern 100 went, and it could have been better, but it definitely could have been worse, which is what I'm telling myself. We went out for the first race, and I was properly in the mode. You know, the head was where it needed to be. I actually managed to get it off the line well. I think I did four positions up on the grid before going into the first corner. I'd already told myself that I was going to leave Manners out of it for Ballochagan, isn't it? Coming down into Ballabeg, and I remember coming in and thinking, someone's going to go up the inside of me here. So I moved over to shut the door a bit, and Aaron Hands appeared up the inside. And I thought, you know what, if it's going to be anyone, I don't mind, it's you, let's have a scrap here. And unknown to me, as we'd powered out of that corner, there was a pile-up started happening behind us. No significant injuries or anything. No, a couple of lads that were involved in it, and you know, besides minor damage to the bike, it's quite a slow area. If you want to crash road racing, that's the sort of place you want to do it. But it meant that we got red flagged at stadium, so we're pulled in there and sort of sat there. The bike was heat soaking, the sun was out. There was, thankfully, a marshal appeared with a crate of water and said, "Do you want a bottle of water?" It's like, yes, that's fantastic. And when the TMs came around to collect us, the bike didn't really want to start. We thought, right, maybe this is related to heat. So we went back in, and they ran, I think it was the other 600 race, the sidecars of the thousands, and then put us back out again. And being back in the paddock and just sort of chilling took me out of the zone a bit. So, like, I went out and the sun was really low and I couldn't see anything. I felt like I'd almost forced myself to go racing there and came round. And it just ended up being quite a clunky and sloppy ride. There was, like, silly little mistakes that were going on, and came back round it in one piece, just conceded several places. And there was actually one of the riders that came past on the last lap, and he came over, and like I mentioned before, you know, when you're having that good scrap, even if you're finishing back, it was good. And I was obviously throwing a little bit of a tantrum because he came over and was like, "Oh yeah, mate, it was a great race, good on that." And I was reasonably short with him. I'd like to think I'm a polite person, but I was quite short. And then once I'd calmed down, I had to go find him again and say, "I'm sorry, I was throwing a bit of a tantrum, like, back in one piece." We've had lots of back and forth. When you line it up and objectively look at that, it was a good race. I felt like I'd left a lot on the table. So going out into Thursday morning, I was back in that zone. Had to get up quite early because we were the first race out. And I was back in the zone. So, all right, we're ready. We're going to attack this and we're going to get going. And we went out for the warm-up lap. Besides the auto blipper not working, well, that's fine. You can ride through that and just do it as if you didn't have a blipper. I came back around, and as soon as I got onto the grid, the bike died. I actually hadn't noticed it at the time. There's a video that I put up on, it's on Facebook and YouTube, actually got that out quite quick. And I'm fiddling around with my glasses, and you hear the visor shut, and I go to rev the bike, and then it's like, oh no, right, get it in neutral and fire it up. And I tried that 3 or 4 times and it just wouldn't run. So I ended up having to get pulled off the grid. Watched the race from there, which was ace. Aaron and Dan Pearson had a great scrap, and there's not many people get to watch from there. I got a glass of orange juice from the control tower. It was all right, but when we came to get back out, I nearly binned the bike because I thought, given the previous day, it was a heat-related issue. So they'd asked me, do you want recovery? And I said, nah, it'll cool down. You know, I can ride it back. I'm only going down half the straight. And Darren Slew was the TM there, and he was waiting for me to go, and the bike wouldn't run. And it would only, like, fire if you gave it throttle. And silly brain said, right, we'll give it 11,000 RPM and just slip the clutch. The back wheel was still on the grass as it came round. So after a race, under escort from a TM, I very nearly had a high side in front of the grandstand at about 10 mile an hour, which wasn't good. So, after a bit of a laugh at that being silly and a long walk back through the paddock, the bike is, it's not happy, but it doesn't seem like it's a massive issue. It's just, it's something small that's hiding. Yeah, it's not worked out well with work this week. It's just for what's happened, and run some very long days. But I managed to have a session on it Monday night, and compression's looking good. There's some questions over the fuel, because it was running on English fuel that has ethanol in it, and that could be making a bit of an issue with it. I don't know how much I believe on that, but there's some people that are way more experienced than me that have said, well, don't rule it out, so we'll try that. I think Friday evening it'll be the next chance I can get in and just let's have a poke, and hopefully it's nothing too major before the Manx.
Well, we have everything crossed for you, Blake, because we want to see you there on the start line in all the races that you're supposed to be. Where can people keep up to date with how your racing's going?
Facebook's probably the best one, because we're quite on that, and a few of the other team members, that's a weird way to say it. Yeah, it's Becky and Tom, really, you know, but they're part of Unrestricted R Racing. You know, it couldn't happen without them, and they're good for putting up stories and things as it happens. If I remember to do, we'll do that. So if you want immediate results for what's going on right at the day, it might be us messing around in the garage, or it might be, you know, how qualifying's gone. Facebook's probably the best place, or Instagram. And then if you wait around a year, I'll actually get the video edited on YouTube and you can watch it on there.
Well, we do wish you all the very best, and especially sort of getting the bike sorted, but not completely sorted until the day before racing starts. Have you set an expectation for yourself? Is there a goal that you would ideally really like to achieve this year?
I don't think so. I think just enjoying it. I was talking to someone recently about it. It was Gary up at Happy Dog, who does a lot of stickers and merch stuff. He said, I hope this is the first of many Grand Prix. I'm like, well, I know lots of people that have tried to quit 4 or 5 times and they keep coming back. It's like, why wouldn't you? And he said, there's a couple of people that have done a lap, they've come back and gone, nah, that's not for me, got on the boat and go. So my goal is to come back and have actually enjoyed it. Yeah, hopefully Kurt Michael is as good as I think it is flying through the village there. I think that's the bit that I'm really looking forward to. But it's throttle therapy, isn't it? I can't really see, although it's one of those unknowns that, you know, I love to worry about, I can't really see a situation where I come back in after being able to just let loose on the greatest track in the world for that amount of time. You know, where else do you get to do that for that long and then come back in and go, nah, I'll take up Tiddlywinks.
I'll tell you what, the sheep are looking forward to it as well. We can't wait to hear the singer. Blake, thank you so much. Blake Kelly, great to talk to him, and honestly we have everything crossed that he gets that machine sorted so he can be on the start line for all the races that he's supposed to be. I'm also intrigued to know what songs you do sing to sheep as you travel past them at quite a speed. I'll put the link on the podcast page and you can have a listen, and also the links to his social media as well, so do give him a follow and check out how he's doing. Journey to a Dream is brought to you by Kawasaki Insurance, and you can find out more about them and how you can get covered by visiting their website. It's kawasaki-insurance.co.uk. My email address, if you'd like to get in touch, is bethsb@manxradio.com. And until next time, take care. Bye-bye.